Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting.
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello, it's Chief. Show the face to all the Covenant and Dr. Catherine Halsey. You've been here, helmet in your arms and a rogue blue AI. Halo season two's arrived. We've come to chat about the vibes and tell
Halo Season 2, Episode 1, Sanctuary is over, but here at Post Show Recaps, we are just getting started. My name is Corey B, or Cortana B, or whatever you'd like to call me. I am back again here for Season 2 of Halo. We're very excited to get in and jump into this. Now, my co-host from last season, the great Joshua Wiggler, I think he's like trapped in some sort of room with daily clones of Kevin Mahadeo coming in to play games with him. So he is currently indisposed. So we are bringing in our pinch hitter from season one, our great friend, Rich Filiberto, DM Philly. Rich, how are you doing?
I am so good. I'm just glad I'm not trapped in that room playing backgammon with Kevin and Josh. I'm not good at backgammon. I don't like nosebleeds, Corey. I'm glad to come in as the pinch hitter to replace the man himself, the Master Chief of PSR, Josh Wiggler.
Yeah, absolutely. We're super happy to have you here. We still have the sort of vibe where I'm the Halo guy. I used to play Halo all the time for anyone who might not have joined us in season one. And Rich, you're coming in sort of, other than season one itself, pretty unspoiled on what's happened in any of the games or anything like that.
Yeah, I'm super blind. I'm a hardcore video gamer, but come 2003, 2004, Blizzard released that game called World of Warcraft, and that was the end of like my experience with consoles. I put my PlayStation 2 down. I never looked back. I've not spent an instant playing Halo. I popped in a couple times during season one with you and Josh, so I watched the show, but that is it. That is like my baseline for Halo is season one of the show. I know a little bit from like what friends have said over the years. I've certainly gotten the feedback around the show since season one aired, but you are the Master Chief here, Corey. I'm just following your lead, man.
I'm Master Chief and I'm Corey Tana. So we're going to have to figure out how that works. But I guess technically last season, they were technically one person. So, and if you didn't watch season one by any chance, like, I don't think you have to. I don't think it's necessarily appointment viewing for you to go back and sit down. I had a lot of fun with it. It was sort of a little divisive, especially among Halo fans. But what I found is that a lot of people who didn't have that background were pretty chill with season one and found it generally enjoyable for the most part. There were some things, but you know, overall solid experience. Was really looking forward to season two. We've got some new showrunners in the house, and so I think that this has really charted a course in a way where we can jump in and dive into this thing, even if you're starting here with us today.
Yeah, I certainly am very familiar with the critiques that come from very passionate fandoms when their properties are adapted, Corey. This is like a really tough pill to swallow sometimes. There was like a lot of controversy around the show. I'm not burdened with any of the baggage of the like canon and any of like the lore behind the games, right? So I came in and took it for what it was, and I thought it was a pretty fun season of TV. There's certainly characters that stand out to me. Some of it like crashed right back into me as we dove into season two, and just the little bit of like peripheral meta text around season two that I've gotten. They seem to be much more focused on character development and really like viewing the lens of the world through the eyes of their core cast. So we'll see where it goes for season two.
And I have heard from fan reaction to this episode that it is much more universally positive at the start of this season, which is great to hear. And I loved it too. You can definitely tell that there is a tonal shift, as you mentioned. There's even some feeling of just like some of the cinematography, the audio, the theme song actually is the Halo theme song now, which is really exciting. There's a lot of good stuff that has sort of just deviated slightly toward a fun direction. For example, there's a twist in the finale that seems to be set up as this big cliffhanger, and they immediately destroy it in the first 45 seconds of episode one. So there is some a little bit of deviation from season one, but for the most part, we do sort of pick up in a nice way. We have good character focus. We're focusing mostly on our friends in the Silver Team, but also have some of these other disparate plot lines that we assume are going to sort of come together in the end, right? So I think that it's going to be good. I'm looking forward to it.
Episode two, especially, I mean, we were bouncing around through a lot of different characters. It really is easy to overlook kind of like how broad the world building is. They're all over the place. There's really like a lot of folks to track, and some of them are really compelling. So I'm curious where it's going to go.
Yeah, absolutely. And we are going to cover season two, episode one and two today. They both dropped and are available on Paramount Plus as of this recording. Season two, episode one is Sanctuary. Season two, episode two is called Sword. And we set up a pretty fun plot, especially as someone who knows the lore of the games, for what's going to come up next. It's a very big, huge event in the games. There's actually the location that they're going to at the end of episode two is a playable location in one of the games. So it's we're gearing up for some fun stuff, but what do you say we just jump into some plot recap for setting the stage here a little bit.
Sounds excellent. I am ready.
Awesome. Awesome. Okay. And I usually don't get to recap the plot, so we'll see how concise I can make it. You know, new heights here in season two today for me. So we have our episode one, Sanctuary. As I alluded to, one of the first things that happens in the episode is John's body, Master Chief. In season one, he ends the finale dying and Cortana basically activating his body and being the, you know, the first person shooter vibe of taking control of John's body to save the day. And we start with John on an operating table. Cortana basically says she needs to sever the connection to stop him from permanently dying. And so they immediately do that just to completely start off this series. Then we jump over to a planet called Sanctuary. And there's something called Operation Shepherd here, where the UNSC, the military, is working to evacuate a very sort of religious village of people off the planet because the Covenant, the aliens of the world, are coming to what they call glass the planet. They're going to rain down plasma fire on the planet, basically completely wiping it of all life, which is a bad thing. But these villagers are sort of, they're very in tune with nature. They say, would you abandon your child? No, so we're not going to abandon our planet. And so there's some sort of fun banter here right off the bat. You can tell that these characters are pretty well fleshed out. They have some fun banter. They talk together, but Chief ultimately notices that one of the teams is missing and goes looking for them. There is an epic fight between camouflaged elites, these Sangheili aliens who are fighting against John. This is an incredible battle. I loved the effects here. Slashing at Chief, dodging, shotgun fight. And we get one survivor from the Marines, a woman named Perez, who is really in the comms team, right? He notices that right away. She's like, we're from the comms team. He's like, oh, I noticed from your aim, right? And so there is a fun relationship between them. But in this moment, obviously she's shocked. He sees some woman in a hood walking away as the glassing of the planet starts, and they sort of bail out of there and barely get away. Now, the elite that we see here from behind the scenes is an important character. It's a named character, so we can get back to that in a moment. But we'll see him several times throughout these two episodes. And moving forward, we're back on the planet Reach. So, you know, we get some like weird static in the shower. He hears this voice that says, you should have stayed with me. And we're looking at this board full of Spartans. More and more of them are being put on standby. And it's because this new guy comes in. And you know, Josh and I talking previously between season one and season two, you know, season one, we had Falth, we had Fleet Admiral Lord Terrence Hood. This is Iowa, Intelligence Operative Ackerson, and Josh coined that. So I'm giving credit to Josh on that. But our friend Intelligence Operative Ackerson, Iowa, it's not as like fluid as Falth, but we'll roll with it. He's sort of Halsey's replacement, right? He's the new director of the Spartan program, and he's got this very ambitious attitude. He goes in and basically says, he believes in you. I believe in you, and everything we're doing here is basically to keep the enemy engaged in the outer colonies so that the people here who matter are feeling safe. And John's like, are they safe? And he sort of just walks away. And now we are back to the rubble. Rubble, 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 rubble. I don't do that as well as Josh either. Rich, how's your rubble, rubble, rubble?
Rubble, 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 rubble.
Oh, that's good. Okay.
Is that okay? Yeah.
Okay, yeah, you're our designated rubble. Okay, so at the rubble, we have an interesting scene where Soren, our ex-Spartan turned pirate, and his wife Lyra and some of his crew are hanging out. They're watching this sort of auction into servitude of refugees, right? They're taking in these refugees, picking the ones they want, and basically accepting them on the condition of servitude. Pretty rough stuff here. And there's a guy named Felix who tries to make his way in and so far doesn't seem successful, but he tries to use his bargaining chip that he knows where Dr. Halsey is. From last season, she sort of escaped and is on the run for a bunch of terrible, awful war crimes that she did. And so he will eventually make his way to Soren. But in the meantime, we are watching John on Reach talking to Ackerson, and they have a really interesting power dynamic. He's talking about what he saw and how they need to warn people. The Covenant are training for something. Why were they there on the planet right before they blew it up? That doesn't make sense. But Ackerson is sort of gaslighting him a little bit. Like, he's like, oh, you must be experiencing these residual effects from all that bad stuff that happened to you, and I care about you. But then, you know, John tries to pull the power move and get up, and he's like, no, sit down. So he's got this really intense side to him. And so we're starting to see some of the barriers break between the two of them. We also see one of the first signs that Master Chief is sort of becoming a very revered hero in the whole time between season one and season two. Soren's son, Kessler, is literally wearing a Chief helmet and playing with an action figure of Master Chief. They are walking through the rubble, and Soren and his wife are having an argument, basically saying he's obsessed with trying to find Halsey, and his crew is not really trusting him, or they're not afraid of him anymore, and she wants to run away. And so ultimately, she will probably get that chance after episode two, but maybe without without Soren. So we have ultimately, we're switching back and forth a lot here. We're back to Reach. We have a couple of different teams here. And one of the teams that is important to the plot, we normally only have gotten the Silver team prior to this point, but we're introduced to the Cobalt team. They have some like locker room banter. You can tell that there is respect for each other there, but they're sort of a little jealous of Silver Team getting all the limelight. They mentioned they're going out to hunt down what happened to a comm relay. They consider it sort of a boring mission, but obviously that pings John a little bit that there was a comm relay where he went to. And that's where the Covenant were sort of training on. And so ultimately, John figures out that there's going to be Covenant. Wherever Cobalt's going, they're going to be there too. He wants Ackerson to warn them, and he yells, and they have another argument where they're sort of both flexing a little bit and trying to see who wins. And ultimately, Ackerson wins again and does not want to warn the team or take any action at all. And so, you know, ultimately, when that all happens, we'll ultimately see John get really sort of like depressed a little bit here. He's going off to some club. He goes to this like seedy back room with this AI hologram that's like, hey there, sailor, what are you looking for? He swipes a card. She turns into a Cortana. He's like getting this like back room session with Cortana just so that he can talk to her and say that I feel like that maybe there's part of you that's still here with me. Very antisocial Spartan vibes for sure. And love to see it. But he also mentions that, you know, he's seeing certain things, and he notices in his sort of flashback when the woman in the hood that he saw on that planet turns his head, it looks like a character who we saw die in season one, our friend McKee. And so that's pretty interesting for Chief. In the meantime, we also see Chief meeting up with our friend Admiral Perangovsky, where she is not an admiral anymore. She's just a regular civilian. And so ultimately she's got this like backroom deal with John, Master Chief, who's like, oh, tell me exactly what's going on, and you and I can work together to actually help these people out. Meanwhile, we've got Soren and his crew. He takes this guy, Felix, over to an abandoned ship with very low gravity, zero gravity sort of situation. And Felix ultimately turns on him, arresting him. The whole thing about finding Dr. Halsey was a ruse to arrest him for all the crimes that he's done and take him in to custody. And so all of this is happening. And at the very end of the episode, we see this sort of this montage voiceover of someone's voice speaking. And it's like this cave wall with markings etched into it. And it turns out that the voice is another one of our friends from season one, who we weren't sure that we'd see again, our friend Quan. And Quan is on the Rebel, sort of like secretly meeting with Soren's son, Kessler, which is very interesting. And she has some intent or some purpose there to teach him about an ancient monster. And that's where we leave the episode. And that's where I'd love to start just talking about this episode real quick. And we'll jump into episode two in just a second. But like, what do you think this monster is? It's this idea of like, it's a very old monster. It's older than the light, than this rock, than your god. It's been here the whole time waiting to meet you in the dark. All it wants is for you to know that there's nothing you could ever love that it can't take away. And so I, from a game perspective, do have sort of an inkling on what this might be referring to. But do you think this is like a symbolic thing? Do you think this is the Covenant, or do you think that this is something else?
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, my interpretation coming in very blind is like, I'm looking to apply it to the things that I know about the world, right?
Yeah,
the world absolutely already feels really expansive, Corey. Like, I think that the things that I really appreciate about Halo so far is like the world building. Like, I feel like they've done a really good job of show, don't tell, of like the religious kind of radicals that have been transplanted 40 years ago and won't move again, even though the plasma strike's coming, and like the ill-equipped comms team, and then even the whole like the indentured servitude kind of sales auction, right? You feel this context of the world, like John just going down into the city when he runs into the Admiral. So when it comes to like this whole metaphor, this fairy tale in the cave, you know, I mean, it's very evocative of like primitive cave paintings, the monsters in the stars, the impossible things that we don't understand. And the way that she was kind of speaking, I'm trying to like apply it to the Covenant, because I know that to some degree there is this meta narrative of war, right? We're on the precipice of like this galactic kind of conflict on a massive scale, and I'm trying to find ways to make the interpretation work, right? To like jam the metaphor into the kind of only box that I have to put it into, which is the Covenant. That's my read, at least.
And I think that the Covenant is no matter what the answer is, I think it's related to the Covenant, if it is not outright the Covenant. And what you mentioned, I think I clocked it too this season, is very sort of faith-based so far in terms of a theme, right? There's the religious people on the planet who you mentioned talking to Chief about how he needs to find his faith. What are you going to believe in? There's so many shots of people being pulled into darkness or the fog, and like, what, you know, the monster that you don't see in the dark waiting to get you. And all of this kind of is culminating. And to be fair, Halo is definitely about faith, even in the games. It's called Halo, right? There's called the Ark in the games. There's all sorts of metaphors and imagery and everything else. The Covenant themselves as an alien species is a religious covenant.
I mean, that's what I was honing in on, right? As I'm reflecting back on season one, I'm thinking so much about that, like, kind of leadership triarchy and the specific, like, entities that kind of raised Maquis, and the whole notion of, like, Maquis and John as, like, these blessed beings, right?
They have,
like, these sacred capacities, this touch that is beyond. There's clearly something with, like, genetic encoding. And I think you get into, like, really interesting space when it comes to, like, exploring faith and science side by side, right? I got to take a really great class when I was in high school focused on Da Vinci, and Da Vinci was like considered this great scientist in retrospect, but so much of his work is church sponsored and is religious in nature, and there's a really interesting interrogation to like extrapolate out of that into a lot of really good science fiction, Corey. I'm thinking of like Battlestar Galactica, even the last couple seasons of Foundation. Like, these are interesting themes right off the top for me.
Absolutely. And the cool thing about all of this is that there is this underlying point of why are the Covenant doing this? I mentioned in season one a couple times, they're looking for something called a great journey, right? They're looking for a way to reach the Halo rings ultimately, but there is this motivation of why. And the why might be a little different in the show than in the games, but ultimately it's going to follow along the very similar lines. And this religious motivation and this what's your place in the universe is going to be a big thing. And you can tell that it is from where the show is focusing on it. But I love these little, even just the villagers standing firm as the planet gets destroyed. We're not leaving this one behind. We are going to stand firm with our planet no matter what happens. It's beautiful. And it's really telling of exactly what they want to go for here and lead us into, I think.
Yeah, it was great. It conveys such awesome character. That, like, shaman, priestess, whatever she is, lady. I love the way they talk about her, Corey. It was very, like, again, like, it just conveys some of the world to me and, like, the perspective of the soldiers in the world, right? And she's like, 40 years ago, you did this. And they have no clue of, like, the history of 40 years ago. They're just these grunts on the ground with the job to do, you know?
I like who's like, I'm a Baptist. Like, he has it's that's great. A great line.
And it's like relatable too, to put something of today's like contemporary age into this future setting really helps like ground us out and bore us to like what we're supposed to be understanding. But just to speak to like the shaman, like that's a, I presume, a one episode character who just was really perfect in the role, right? Like beyond like the actual actor and like playing the part. I just think having that character there as like a foil to offer this pushback of like, you guys did this already. Like 40 years ago, we ran away and you left us here. The world we came, we like left was like beautiful. It had water and trees. And now we're on this barren place. I'm like, what are you going to do with this? You're going to shuffle us off the side. So I don't know. There was a lot of stuff like this in Foundation season two. I'm probably going to evoke it a lot while we're talking through Halo, because it was a recent sci-fi property that I just kind of blew my socks off. But a really strong start. Right.
Yeah.
Into like the action scene and John like fighting the Covenant. Like, I thought it was a really good entry into season one for sure.
Absolutely agreed. And I think that ultimately the funny thing about all that is that she was ultimately right. Right. We go into the scene with Ackerson basically saying, yeah, we don't really care about the outer colonies. They can get glassed all we want as long as people here feel safe. So in some ways she was right that it was, you know, sort of sad. It's fruitless. It's, there's no way out, but that's ultimately what she did was the right way to go. And I think that ultimately There's this funny stark contrast too between all that happening, these big armored giant super soldier Spartans, especially now that they have their pellets taken out and they're like actually fun, where in season one they had some fun moments, but like they were pretty like statuesque in season one a lot of the time, with the exception of John. We have like this scene at the beginning with Vanek basically talking about, oh yeah, he took out his pellet, he's like, I watch programs sometimes, like animals and stuff. And then Chief like faces this hill and he's like, oh, did you know that an Ibex can climb an 80 degree incline? And that's like in the video games, right? When you have like allies hanging out with you, you just hear all this idle banter all the time. It's a classic video game thing, not just exclusive to Halo,
but, sure,
you know, it feels like that to me. So I love all of this like throwaway dialogue, and it's just so weird that you have this planet about to be blown up and you have this very religious little village who's trying to fight for themselves, and then you have these Spartans just chatting it up with each other, making jokes, right? It gets pretty serious pretty quickly. And but throughout the entire episode and episode two, you get all these fun one-liners and fun like moments with the Spartans that I'm really loving.
Dude, Vanek is great. Like, I don't know the Spartans well at all, and I don't know how many of these characters are being like pulled straight out of the lore or the canon or whatever, but like the voice on this guy, Bentley Kalu, who's playing Vanek, like he's just got that awesome sound that I think is really important. I think it's like understated in a show where we're gonna have these guys in helmets a lot of the time, to have that really distinctive voice like carries a lot. But he's got that awesome, like, you know, I only give so many F's charm, you know, and any man who could like invoke the vertical ascension of the Ibex with such clarity, like speaks to my heart, Corey. I'm like, so perpetually impressed by mountain goats of all varieties, especially the Ibex, for their like climbing abilities. It's really wild. It's something to see.
I mean, it's an impressive fact. I mean, Kai looked at him like he was like saying something weird. I'm like, wow, really? I didn't know they could do that. That's pretty awesome. But I'm super happy that they all still team took out their pellets. It's gonna make a much more fun dynamic between all the Spartans and let them really like riff off of each other a lot better. And to something you were saying, Chief is the only one in Silver Team who is actually ripped from the game.
There are
some potential, like there's been some screenshots posted where there might be some other Spartans that we know from the games or from other lore. There are also some Easter eggs, like when we had that board of all the Spartans with all the names, there were Easter eggs in there. There was a mega team in there, a couple other Spartan teams that like we have heard a reference to or seen, but Chief is really the main one for the show perspective so far.
That's, I know that like a lot of franchises that I love out there, like my beloved Star Wars, right? There's so much other property, like there are comic books around Halo, and like there have been a couple of novels, haven't there? Or am I like
missing? Oh yeah, a lot, quite a lot. And it's done something very similar to that. I know Star Wars has done before, where they release a new game and then they retcon a bunch of the canon, and then a bunch of books become invalidated. So they've gone through all of that.
That's part of the nature of the beast with the ever-growing fandoms in the modern age, you know. I was really curious, just because coming away from season one, like I think one of my criticisms as a viewer is like Master Chief was not the most interesting character to me, right? And some of the other Spartans, like, and this is very intentional, right? But they're such blank slates, you know. And my big takeaway was like, oh, Kai was a character that I was really engaged with. Soren, like, just blew me away. I'm like in love with Bokeem Woodbine, you know. So coming back, getting a little bit, and just in these two episodes, just a little bit, we'll talk about Riz more, but like digging into Vanek and giving him some characterization, I think it goes a long way. Like, if this is going to be our core group and I'm supposed to be invested in them, then you need to like do some work to invest me, and I appreciate that they are. Right,
absolutely. I think they do a great job both in elevating the rest of Silver Team. And we said that Kai was the most interesting character season one out of Silver Team. And she's actually taken the most backseat in the first two episodes. And I love that, because they're really giving us time to actually understand who the rest of them are, including John himself, who I think is starting to fill a specific niche in the team too, with his role as their leader, but also with his role as this revered hero that is being vaulted up across the entire galaxy, basically, as this symbol of hope and freedom for the world, walking past literal projections of himself, making poses. And I think that between all of a Silver Team, it really does feel a lot more balanced, and like we're really getting to know those characters. So I totally agree.
It's a good choice. You know, it's a really tough thing to do. I'm talking about Masters of Air over on Apple TV with Ariel, and we're tracking these bomber crews in World War II. And it's so tough because you have this big ensemble around all of your leads. And when it's really easy to look, it's a story about like American soldiers in World War II. So it's a bunch of white guys wearing the same clothes, Corey. And like, it's really easy to lose track. And you know, when you're dealing with, I think, especially wartime stories that are using the tension of like life and death and loss and camaraderie, you need to be invested in the characters, right? So I really thought it was a strong like showing from Silver Team in these two episodes to just ground me out in them as a group more, like big profound kind of change there for me.
And this is why season two, in some ways, season one, in some ways, feels almost like a prologue to me, right? Because we went through the entire season with most of them, or at least half of Silver Team, not taking out their pellets or not taking them out until the very end, which gives us no emotion to the characters whatsoever. So in some ways, the fact that this is all hand-waved and we're like, we get the fun characters right off the gate, even the ones who came in Cobalt Team who didn't have their pellets taken out, had such fun banter with them. And it just felt so much more immersive. And like you said, the more stuff that we get into, because things are going to keep getting more serious, and the more of that we get into with them, the better, now that we're starting to really understand who they are. So absolutely. Any other thoughts on season one? I know obviously we'll go over a little more once we get through episode one.
My only like final note about episode one here is we get this introduction of Ackerson, who I'm definitely going to call Ackerman a couple of times along the way here. But so this guy, first of all, he really reminds me of like a Burn something or another. I think the guy was in season one. The guy he's like got this look that is like insanely familiar, Corey. And I feel like I should know who he is, but I don't, and I can't place him. He's being played by Joseph Morgan. And I don't know if I really like his portrayal because it's so mustache twirling and over the top, or if I'm a little bit like rolling my eyes. Like part of me is like, okay, we're doing the like, we have to hate each other. We're going to totally like just reject everything that you're telling us here, even though you were the boots on the ground, Master Chief. It feels a little bit like over the top and a little bit blunt, but I appreciate like having a villain who's so overtly villainous, right? Like there's no ambiguity here to this guy at all. He may not be like a villain in the traditional sense that he has evil machinations, but he's such an antagonist to John. And like, he just seems like such an absolute dick, man. I mean, like Biff Tannen vibes here, Corey. And like, I love Biff Tannen, but like, that's where I don't know how I feel about Ackerson yet. If it's like too much, if it's a little too overt, or if I'm like enjoying that it's this over the top.
Yeah, and Ackerson is, he seems like a very smart guy, and I think that a lot of I think having a little bit of lore context here does slightly help with Ackerson, because he does have motivations that we have, at least in our other timeline or game timeline, he does have some motivations that we haven't clued in on yet, which maybe, because I think what that might amount to me is that his motivations aren't clear yet. And why is he just shutting John down for these legitimate concerns? Why is he gaslighting him? What is his intent and his purpose? We get a little more nefarity going on for him in episode two, and it gives a little bit of a clue, but ultimately he still is kind of just massive dick, right? Like he's just like he is, he's got this polish to him, and he's got this authority, and he's got so much assertiveness, but ultimately he's meeting his own ends, and it leaves you to wonder, like, why is he doing things this way?
The thing that got me really, as I like boil it down, is that that TV trope of I'm the guy who's going to like replace your supervisor, and I'm not even going to make a modicum of an effort to win you over at all. I'm going to walk into the room and just be an absolute dick and piss everybody off immediately. And I was just like, dude, are you like incentivized at all to like win these people over? Like, shouldn't you want them to like you? You're being so antagonistic and like, you know, pretentious and all of it. Like, oh my God. And then you have the meeting with John, and you think there's going to be a little bit of like wooing almost.
Yeah, because John's like, oh, I studied your file. Like, I respect that you're like, you've got combat experience. And he just totally just just like,
despite the bad first impression, Corey, yeah. He like opens the door to be like, okay, let's try again, let's restart. And Ackerson's just like, nah, man, like, F you. So I like came out of it like, okay, we'll see. I'm curious about him, but he feels to me like, if I'm like picking holes, like the kind of weakest new element where I'm like, all right,
sure,
this guy is just so over, you know. Said, like, there's certainly more to dig around in episode two with him and his motivations.
Yeah. And that's still really good perspective to know. I do think that if this goes the way I think it'll go, you will hopefully not like sympathize with it, but at least have some more understanding on why he's being a jerk to the Spartans,
okay,
why he's motivated the way he's motivated. I feel like if they go the direction that he goes in the main canon, then we'll find that out. For sure.
Okay,
but I mean, I totally can see that, like, coming from like the way you said it. I'm like, yeah, he totally is just sort of like an unjustifiable.
It's just was like the TV trope thing, you know, I'm the new boss, I'm a total a-hole. The guy that I'm thinking of is Bern Gorman, who he just like looks so much like he was Watch degenerates who like kills Craster and drinks out of his skull at the end of Game of Thrones. Like, he's a total maniac. He's in Pacific Rim. He's a really great actor, but like Ackerson just reminds me of him so much. It's kind of wild.
It's funny because like I didn't have that perception of him at all, but now I like I said, now that you're saying that, I'm like, okay, I could see it. Well, awesome. We'll definitely keep our eye on that and figure out where it goes, and we do get some more in episode two.
Discover why critics are calling Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes the best film of the franchise.
What a wonderful day!
It's a jaw-dropping spectacle that demands to be seen on the biggest screen possible.
I need to go.
Hang on.
It is our time.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Now playing only in theaters. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
With Lucky Land slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of the Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play the Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
So let's jump in. Let's talk through what happens in episode two. We start with our friend Dr. Catherine Halsey. Didn't see her at all in episode one, and she's in this like very like picturesque room, and a young girl brings her tea and like is really interested to learn how to play backgammon with her. We don't know who this girl is. Halsey's sort of talking to her and sort of placating her a little bit, but she obviously wants information from this young girl. She's asking her what's outside of the room. Oh, there's a man. What's his name? What's he like? But then her nose starts bleeding. And if you've watched season one, that is a very strong indicator that someone is a clone, because if you're cloned very poorly, you live a very short amount of time, and the nosebleed is sort of the first sign that your life is almost done. So the girl freaks out, and Halsey tries her best to get her to say anything before she dies, but she just plops over on the table. And so we get that a couple times in this episode, where she just is continuously trying to work over this poor clone, or, you know, a new clone every time. And it's sort of this weird perpetuity, like, of just madness. It's like almost like it's a torture. I'm not totally sure. We'll talk about that for sure. We jump over to another sort of locker room scene, but this time it's with Riz. And we sort of alluded to this. We get a lot of a spotlight on Riz in this episode, and you can see her scars. She took a nasty grenade hit in season one, and she has these really terrible looking scars on her arm and on her back. She tells Kai that she would never put her pellet back in again, even if it would help her with the pain, and she's really insistent that she wants to keep working and keep trying. And so, you know, there are some conversations about what's been going on with Ackerman. John tells Kai about what he saw. He saw McKee. Kai's like, that's not possible. I shot McKee and killed her. And so there's a little bit of suspicion, like, what is John seeing? Is something wrong with him? Is he compromised? A little bit of questions in the air there. And now, of course, we have our Spartan board, the one we talked about before. And this is one of my favorite scenes. I love this. This is pure comedy. There's this guy who's changing out the board, and Cobalt team status is being changed to this red standby on the board. So he's flipping on the board and changing the things. And John and Kai and later Vanek are all just grilling this poor dude. Like, why are you doing that? Why are you putting, why are you changing them to standby? They haven't come back yet. He's like, oh, I'm just doing my job. So like, they're like, what are you doing? It's like, they told me to change it. So I'm changing it. That's what my job is. And so like, they're like, this is like pure personality. They didn't need to do this at all. And I love so much that they did. I don't mean to stop down too hard on the scene, but this was amazing.
I mean, it really belies the ways that like bureaucracies work and how information moves and how like those little relationships matter, right? You get these former Marines pulling like the guy whose job it is to change the that's an intimidating group of individuals to be interrogating. Oh, yeah. You know? Yeah.
I was dying. It was hilarious. So yeah, this poor guy, I think sort of implies, he doesn't even say anything, but he doesn't not say anything when they ask if it was Ackerman. So they're like, okay, Ackerman did this. So thankfully the guy just gets to keep doing his job and changing the board like he was asked to, I assume. And so we are sort of moving over to the rubble for a moment. We've got Quan Ha, she's back. She's got this ear tag sort of thing in that sort of marks her as an indentured servant. And there's like this bouncer, sort of like enforcer kind of guy who's scanning them. So she slips away from him, gets into a big chase, and finds her way down some sort of garbage chute where there's this conveyor off into space. And the guy chases her, says he's part of the Spiffs. Which I don't know, that could be in lore, but I don't know if it is. And she ultimately takes out both him and his friend, takes out her sort of ear tag and uses it to kill this guy, and basically runs away. And ultimately, she's going to go talk to Soren's son, who kind of Kessler, Soren's son Kessler, and basically says, yeah, I know that the grown-ups are after you, right? I know that all this stuff is happening. And she basically says, you and your mom are in danger and bad things are going to happen. Kind of actually makes him a little mad because she says his dad's not coming back. He runs away and she gets really frustrated. And in the meantime, when all this is happening, Soren's wife is trying to get Soren's ship back and getting really frustrated at his crew. She's saying he would never have left you behind. This is his ship. This is why I want the ship. So she's clearly trying to run away on Soren's ship, but trying her hardest to work with his former crew, who Quan was told got bought out at the time of that fight by, I cannot remember the name of the, there's like an individual name, Ruby Ann, it was. Oh. And I've never heard that name before. So I just wanted to tag that just in case there's something else that comes up there that bought out Soren's crew.
I wonder, I mean, during that whole, like, I don't mean to be jamming you up, but during that whole kind of purchase of the indentured servants, he kept like checking with the other kind of pirate off to his left, right? There were like this other really important figure that I didn't recognize that he seemed to be like doing a lot of like visual confirmation with as they were like.
Antares is his name. And Antares is named very explicitly many times, so I definitely clocked it, but I don't know who he is other than he's just a member of the crew. And there's another woman there who Karina, who is also like a named member of his crew. Those were the two. I think
I meant even like during when they're about to purchase the indentured servants, when they're doing the whole auction.
Yes.
There's like another seeming like pirate captain, right? They're doing like a whole like pirate lord thing. So I got the kind of impression that it was like the captain of another ship. She's the one who like bids on, I think, the criminal there. And there's just like sort of making eye contact with this other captain a lot. So I don't know. That's like my immediate thought of like.
Yeah, we'll have to flag that too. And we don't really know. That's kind of most of what we get on the rubble the entire episode, and so it is very up in the air to kind of understand where the rubble is going to actually tie in to the main plot, which is something that I probably said verbatim in season one. So eventually the rubble will gain relevance, I'm sure of it, but you know, Soren's gone, and I think that there's just an interesting power dynamic in the rubble, but we don't even have Soren there anymore. So it's very interesting. We've just got Quan and Soren's family in terms of main characters. So we'll have to just kind of see what happens in that arena. And I hope that it doesn't drag out as long as it did in season one. But so far it's fine, I think. So that's the rubble. And meanwhile, Riz is sort of training hard, and she's got this friend of hers with her named Lewis, I believe is his name, and he asks her how she's doing, how bad is it, helps her stretch out, and he has this moment where she says, you know, I don't want anyone to be looking, and he's like, no one's looking, and she says, how would you know? And it actually turns out that Lewis is blind, and we learn later that Lewis actually became blind because he was a member of the Spartan 2 program along with Riz, along with all the other people, but he started becoming blind as a result of all these painful, awful augmentations that the Spartans received and lost his vision. So he's sort of this guiding character for Riz to say, you don't have to be a Spartan. You know, yeah, Spartans never die, whatever else, but there's life outside of being this warrior, right? And you can live it if you want to. So he actually convinces her to move over and talk to a friend of his. Danilo is his name. And just jumping ahead to that, you know, they were talking a little bit. Lewis kind of gives his backstory, everything that he's sort of witnessed, and he presses on her scars, and sort of she realizes the pain that she has and says that she should let it go. Her life belongs to her, right? Your life is hers. It belongs to you. And so she has this moment before they go out on the mission at the end where she's really sort of reconciling her situation and her injury and possibly a disability that she might have moving forward. So that's definitely something to keep an eye on with Riz and sort of the backstory that we're sort of jumping into with her. And then, of course, we have the rest of Silver Team, which sometimes also includes Riz. They're going through this really cool real life combat training. It's a live fire combat training, which is just wild, but I guess they're Spartans, so they can handle it. Running through this really beautiful green planet at superhuman speeds, climbing up cliffs, taking shots at each other, and ultimately Riz falls down, smashes herself on a rock near this waterfall. Vanek makes a hilarious joke again and over explains it, which is also equally hilarious. And then Chief is pushing them really hard to run it back again, specifically targeting Riz. Riz takes another really nasty fall, even worse this time, can't even get up. Chief sort of tries to get her to push and doesn't. And he, in frustration, says, I'm doing this so that we can train because they're training too. And so, ultimately, all that happens, they continue training together, and Ackerson at some point pulls Kai away. and tells Kai that he's sort of worried about John and she's really close to him. So you can help me with John. Is there any way that like he's a threat to his team or to himself? And she goes to bat for him. She maybe over explains a little bit why she thinks he might be a little wound up, but she says absolutely no worries with him whatsoever. And he's basically like, well, I really hope that he appreciates how loyal you are to him, and ends that conversation. And John, meanwhile, is going to confront Perez, the Marine who survived the encounter on this planet Sanctuary from episode one. Her name is Talia Perez, is her full name. And when the door is answered, her mom is behind her making a big family dinner, which was amazing, and invites him. And she's like, you're very large. And he's like, yeah, yes, ma'am. And so he goes in and talks to dinner. They all pray. Talia's relatives are all just kind of just like jumping on her about like, ooh, you and this guy, you know, are you together? And you brought a guy home. And the guy asks John about his KDR, which is a hilarious thing. Great video game reference. And then they realize he's actually a Spartan.
That's what got me, Corey. That's the point that broke me, where he's like, would you kill Death Race? Yeah, I don't keep track. As somebody that's played like way too much League of Legends, like, I don't keep track either, John. Like, oh my
God. Yep. Such a badass response too. So they're like, oh shoot, this is like actually a Spartan here at dinner. So this is and I love this too, because he had this stoic John face, right? Like he's doing, Pablo Schreiber's doing a great job of channeling the quiet stoic vibes of John this season. And I think that was a very deliberate change for him. But there was this moment where he's quiet after that line and stays with completely stoic. But then after several seconds, a tiny little smile pops on his face and they all start cracking up. And I love that so much. It's like a little introduction to more personality for him while still staying true to the original character too. That whole scene was just magnificent, start to finish. And it's like such a random thing, but again, they got to keep doing this thing. It's awesome. Yeah. And of course, after some time at the dinner, they pull away. John and Talia, Corporal Perez, basically says that she didn't tell Ackerson anything because she didn't know how to explain what happened. Why did I survive? Why did they not kill me? And why did they give me a medal for just surviving? So they sort of bond a little bit about that trauma. John basically says it doesn't ever get better, but it does get further away. And sort of have a little nice moment there. Just a friendly moment between the two of them. And then back with Halsey, we finally get the culmination of the moment with all the clones just coming in. She basically admits, she's like, why is there a pomegranate tree in this room? I have a very specific moment in my childhood that involves burning down my dad's pomegranate tree. And I've only one person could possibly know about that. And we know that that's in reference to Cortana, who was basically made off of her brain. So she would know that memory. And so she realizes that our friend Ackerson, I almost said Ackerman that time, Ackerson jumps in and he's like, yeah, it's me. And basically says, let's not jump ahead of ourselves. Cortana's secure. Don't worry about John. And we still don't know what he wants with Halsey, but he's continuously tormenting her with more clones of this young girl, Julia, over and over again, which is where we leave Halsey this episode. Very interesting stuff. And ultimately, while all this is happening, two things occur after this, right? John is pulling up looking for where Cobalt went. And he's getting creative because it was sort of purged from the system. And Ackerman goes to find our first sighting this season, a different look too, interestingly. Cortana, our AI friend. And to be fair, in the games, Cortana literally changes her appearance literally every single game. So it's actually not that off par for her look to change a little bit. But she seems different, like maybe she was reset or something else happened to her, but she's helping Ackerman with these complex simulations. She's not allowed to go outside the network, so she's not totally sure. She's basing her predictions off of limited data, basically, probably because he doesn't want her to gain her memories back, essentially. But she says there's a 97% probability of presumably something really terrible happening. And there's really no viable way to prevent it from happening. And as he leaves, he says, you know, I'll come back again, But she says, oh, well, according to the simulations, that's not possible. And so you know that something's going to go down very soon. Meanwhile, lending to this point, John actually finds what happens to Cobalt team going to shut down this relay. Turns out the relay is on Reach, the very planet that almost all of season one and season two was headquartered in. The very planet that he is currently on. The flight never left the planet at all. And so he sneaks Silver Team out on a Pelican, and they are disengaging autopilot, sneaking over there and saying the Covenant are on Reach. And they are about to get into some business here at the Visegrad Relay, which is a game. That's the game location I mentioned before. So I'm sure there's going to be some combat taking place there. And at the very last scene, we go to that relay before Silver Team gets there. There's Marines moving down a dark hallway. Their commander is kind of an idiot, like moving his troops like squad by squad into darkness as they get slaughtered, and he's the last one just standing there by himself. Like, dude, what are you doing? Marines are not always the smartest in the games either.
Friggin' so, TV Marines, Corey. Come on.
They are for sure NPCs in this situation. It's definitely, again, pulled through the darkness scenario. And then as the second group comes in, an energy sword lights up from this elite and picks him up. And then we see our confirmation that the chief is not going crazy. McKee is still somehow alive or reborn or something and working with this elite. And she asks this elite to open the door. The elite's like, what are we doing here? We actually see some dialogue from him saying that this is not an honorable battle at all. And she's like, can you just open the door, please? And he does. And it's the other half of the relic, which notably, too, Ackerson was, before he talked to Cortana, with the other half of the relic and even tried touching it. So I think he like sort of has a little complex too, right? Like why doesn't it work for me? But McKee's back. She's got this relic. She's about to touch it as the episode ends. So I think everything is going to spiral into chaos. But what I do want to mention for Halo fans and for your sake is that this elite is credited as the Arbiter. That's its official name. Now in the Halo series, there are many Arbiters. There's an Arbiter that a lot of fans like a lot. And that's not this Arbiter, but he is the current Arbiter. It's a religious figurehead position that elites occupy that is sort of like an honorable warrior. It's like a holy warrior sort of thing, but it's like literally a very high level position, but it's also a little bit dishonorable too. Like earning honor through dishonor sort of situation, depending on how you get the Arbiter position. I probably butchered that for lore people, but that's how I understand it anyway. And so the Arbiter is, like I said, a named character, someone who I thought we might even see in season one, but there is finally an Arbiter here. So this is going to be, and the reason I'm calling this out is this is going to be a character. We already got dialogue from him. We've seen him many times. He was also the one that was on Sanctuary. And John could immediately tell that he was the leader. And I'm really curious to know what happens with him, because I do think we have the chance at some dialogue with not just McKee with the Arbiter. And we haven't seen Miranda Keys yet this season. And I do wonder if maybe that might come into play with her maybe speaking a little, saying Heli, the elite's language, and communicating with someone like this who is giving us actual like named character dialogue sort of vibes. I don't want to read too much into the casting part of it, but you also can tell that he's the Arbiter from his armor. So there's a couple different ways that we know for sure that it's him.
Yeah, I know that there's a couple of like interesting points with the elites, like despite my lack of familiarity with like the canon or the background, like I've got a little bit of an understanding just from doing my homework prepping for season two that like there are a couple really notable elites that like maybe leave rank and file. I'm curious. I'm interested to see where that goes. Just to like all of episode two, I think like to go to the Master Chief part of it, him like going to the dinner scene was really interesting. interesting to me, Corey. There's a beat at the end of the Wheel of Time season one where we do this with the character that I really love in the Wheel of Time, and it creates this opportunity where you put them in with this family. And I thought that, especially for John, who is this total blank slate, right? Like the whole part of like what we're dealing with Halsey is like these war crimes of like rounding up children. John's like parent, John was replaced by a clone that just died, right? If I'm remembering that right, like Halsey did this terrible stuff and robbed him of all of the accoutrements of humanity, i.e. a family, loved ones, right? So for him to go into this environment and see the dichotomy between he and this comms officer of like, oh, this thing that I yearn for, this like hole that I feel like I have, like I don't have these emotional connections, I don't know how to talk to people, right? I mean, that's what he's like having the whole backroom conversation with Cortana about. And then he goes in there and he's being like revered and hero worshipped by the brothers, and like all this projection from the mom of like, oh, you're gonna date my daughter. But he's taking in the reality of like, oh, this woman has everything to lose, right? Like she has this whole family and all these people invested and connected, and like how hard it must be to walk away from that. I really appreciated getting clarity on why she wouldn't corroborate John's story. That notion of like the PTSD kind of like informing her panicking. I don't know how to explain it. The survivor's guilt.
Yeah.
It's a little sloppy to me, candidly, but I just appreciate that we address it, because it was a big like question that I came out of episode one with Ackerson. And again, the mustache twirling, I'm like, dude, you're being so over the top, but like this should be so cut and dry. There's literally a witness here to corroborate what John said. So the fact that she did actually, like Ackerman's telling the truth, she denied the truth of what happened, that's really interesting, right? Just jumping around a little bit, like Soren, like I really love Bucky Woodbine as an actor, but Soren is the most interesting character to me by far, and I really hope he's not dead, Corey. Like, I'll believe it if he is. The whole like reversal of the arrest I thought was really well done. Like I went from believing the indentured servant was more than he seems to accepting, no, he's exactly what he seems, to then being like surprised by the reversal at the end. So that's super effective, like very well done in all of the execution there. And I love Soren's wife too, like pushing back on the pirate crew, the little bit of like humanity of like, they know that they really have this guy over, and there is a little like, oh man, like we now have to deal with the fallout. Like we are, this woman is in our face. We are trying to figure out how to steal a ship. He does have a son. Like the weight of that was all really compelling stuff to me.
And it's funny because I was of two minds when I first started seeing how well Soren's wife Lyra was like actually coming into her own as a character this season, because on one hand I'm like, do we really need more characters on the rubble who are following around outside of all this stuff? But on but also like in season one she didn't have much. She was mostly kind of just there. She had a couple lines that were interesting, but I kind of love that we're kind of seeing her come into her own and having an opportunity to sort of shine by herself. And same as her son, who obviously is now for some reason or another sort of being educated by Quan about all things, you know, prophetic about what's going to happen potentially and what this monster is and all this stuff. And I kind of do like that for their characters.
Yeah, I'm really high on Lyra. I you know, I don't want to push like too much politics into this, but it's really interesting to me that she's super capable. She does have 100% the right read. Like just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get you. But also like she's pretty much stripped of all the actual power she would need to do anything about what she's realized, right? And this feels like very parallel to the plight of a lot of women that I know in reality. Like it's a very compelling story for me to step into, and I'm really intrigued by it. I like the moral complexity of Soren's crew having to like deal with the fallout here, that like she is here, his son is here. How does that impact them? How is that going to change their decisions? Like we see at least a little humanity from some of them. The other side of what's happening, like the Quan dynamic with this kid, like straight up, I think it's like a bridge too far. I appreciate that we want to like carry the story forward with Quan, and I don't mind her role here, but it just was like an extra wrinkle. There's a lot of moving pieces, Corey, and I'm a pretty discerning TV viewer, and I was a little like, what's going on? Like, why is the kid with her? Where are they? I thought she's on the run. Like, why is she still here with Soren? So I'm a little bit like confused and unmoored there.
I do feel you. Yeah. It's like she ended at episode one talking to him in the cave, and then in episode two, she was running away from the law and then came back to him in the cave. So
I have all these questions of like, is she on the run or is she not? Is Soren her ally or is he not? Like, do they know that the kid is with her? Is he like intentionally with her because his mom feels like she's in danger? There's just all of this lack of clarity around that that's making it hard for me to like, focus in totally on what they're trying to get at, I guess.
And I think too that was sort of the problem a lot of people had with Quan in season one is that there was just a lot of like, okay, well, what are we doing here? And so I do think that we need to hopefully see some real connections with Quan again soon for anything like this to pay off. But you're right. There's a lot of questions that kind of can take away from feeling connected to the plot or what her or Kessler's significance is going forward. I could absolutely see that. I do like that Kessler is like sort of developing his own personality too here in this season, but you're right, it's totally a fair point. And Kessler, I do think it's kind of funny that he's like wearing all this Master Chief, like it's this great Master Chief helmet, and like his dad was a Spartan too, but he's like, no, I'm a Master Chief fan.
I love the action figure, dude. I love an in-universe action figure. It's very, very fun, you know?
Absolutely. And so, yeah, I mean, I think that everything going on in the rubble is, again, like, I want to know where it goes. It needs to make some connections. I don't think that Soren's dead though. I mean, I hope he's not, but you know, he was arrested. I feel like it could even be a situation where maybe he's just being rounded up again. Maybe he's going to get brought back to Reach, but then Reach gets attacked or something. Like, you know, there could be several ways that this actually could be good for our boy Soren, getting him sort of back into the mix a little bit.
Yeah, I'm with you there. I shouldn't say dead. It was pretty clear he was being arrested, right? But like narratively dead. I don't want him to turn into a MacGuffin, right?
Yeah.
I like him as like an active agent in the story. Like he just is this wrinkle that is like outside the Marines. That's pretty interesting to me. And I think you get an interesting like other side of that with the Riz storyline and everything that's going on there. I mean, that's like really interesting. Just in the notion again of the way that like we as people in the 21st century tie our identity to our profession, and all of a sudden, like when you're ill-equipped to do that, or you lose your job, or you know, you're injured in her case. I mean, certainly the case with like so many professions, these people who are athletes, all this kind of stuff, when you can no longer perform like the functions, like what that means about your identity, how it breaks you down. And especially when it comes to people that have literally been like AI adjusted with these pellets in them to like just identify in this very singular fashion and value themselves in this very singular fashion. I mean, I think a lot of people can relate to like being in an industry and getting like steeped in that industry, even if it's not like the military industrial complex, like being in that cycle every day. And like, these are the people around you, and this is how you value yourself. And this is where you like look for achievement, and your dreams begin to like change in terms of like upward mobility within this trajectory, not the wide, broad options of a person, right? This notion that like there's a life outside being a Marine, right? And like you can't see it at all because you're so far down the rabbit hole, but it is not actually the end of the world. There is not a need to like kill yourself because you can't do your job anymore, right?
Exactly.
That's compelling, right? That's like good narrative in all kinds of different venues. And it's certainly interesting here, and certainly for a character who is like just not been developed until now, that I'm like, okay, now we have an angle of approach that I'm like really engaged to follow Riz as she like works through this, you know?
Yeah, I love it, and I'm really relating to her heart, and she was not that much of an entity last season, so I do really like that for her. And I also will say, everything that you mentioned, I also think it's weirdly juxtaposed with the same idea when you saw John going to this weird hollow back room of like lack of connection with society, lack of emotional connection, which is a very prevalent thing in our world too. And, you know, not necessarily knowing how to form social connections, becoming disconnected from others, not knowing how to get, you know, express your emotions or who you can express them to comfortably. And I think those two things, that battle with Riz and just showing that in John of, you know, where these people are at socially and emotionally is a wild and potent combo. You wouldn't necessarily expect you to like have a situation where, you know, you've got these super soldiers out there who are struggling with, you know, potentially reaching past the point of their usefulness in their profession, like you mentioned, and sort of like, where do I go from here? Is there life outside this world? But also, like, once you get outside the world, you don't have any connections. You don't have any, you know, emotional vulnerability whatsoever. And I do think that that's where also Riz needs to make connections with, you know, this guy Dalio, who or Danilo, excuse me, who is like, I think sort of therapist vibes, I'm feeling like. And so I think that will be really fascinating to continue to watch.
Yeah, I'm really curious to see where it goes. To like, you know, to the punctuation of that, like John doing the tough dad thing of like, look, like if you're gonna stay in the suit, then I'm gonna like push you to the absolute extreme. Like, we need to be able to handle this and things are about to get really dangerous. Like, that always works for me. You know, I like Kai being like having a little bit of mercy and compassion there, that like, what are you doing? You know, can't you see here? But pushing it further, just to like wrap the bow on it, you know, the Ackerson stuff, I like the clarity here. I appreciate, like, okay, he's like full villain vibes. He's got a lair. He's got a safe with a bunch of important stuff in it. Cortana was a character that I was wildly intrigued by last season. And so I'm really glad to see that, like, she's still in play with Ackerson. This is a fun trope of, like, the villain kind of, like, siloing one of our important characters so they can have, like, just these individual conversations. To the recasting, like, that tracks with the game. I'm not, like, precious about it, but I did really like the casting last time, so we'll see how that works.
So I will say the voice is the same.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Yes, it's Jen Taylor, but the it was more like CGI-ish sort of face.
Yes.
And at this season they made it more realistic looking, like more like just like putting a filter over a human sort of.
Sure.
So I think that was the biggest thing. It might even technically be the same actress portraying body, but I think last season Jen Taylor, the original game voice of Cortana, and still the voice of Cortana, might have just done some mocap for it. So, like, I'm not exactly sure, you know, where it all landed, like, in the exact nuances. But it's, like, half a recast is what I would say.
I appreciate them using the original voice actor. I love this. Is a thing that we've talked about a lot in the Star Wars universe, is we're transitioning like all of these animated characters over. I think whenever you can keep continuity there, it's so powerful to do so. But like the final element, I guess, is just Dr. Halsey, we haven't talked about much. I really appreciate your clarity about the clones, because I wouldn't have put that together with the nosebleeds. I was reading that environment as much more AI or like artificial kind of prison, because I'm jumping to the Cortana notions. We had like the first kind of discussion of like, oh, the tree is going to grow a fruit, like these fruits with seeds in them, and each one's going to burst with juice, and the whole tie back to the pomegranate seeds. It's really interesting. Just visually, like, you say pomegranate and I think of those seeds exploding everywhere, like the blood red stains of pomegranates, Corey. Pomegranate's like a really like religious kind of holy fruit in some perceptions. In ancient Rome, there's a lot of stuff going on there. So like, to the faith, like kind of suggestions, allusions that are blanketing the season so far, the pomegranate thing really hooked into that for me. And I was like, that is an intentional choice. That's interesting.
That's funny too, that you say that, because she also in Halsey's story mentions that her dad was like, hell-bent on making sure this tree grew, even though he moved it to a planet where it was not native, and still worked super hard to the point of just driving his daughter mad that she like had to help him every morning with this dumb tree, right?
In the same
right?
way that, like, the olive branch has iconography beyond olive oil, right? The right. pomegranate has, like, a lot of stuff with, like, Persephone and Hades, Greek mythology. Like, it ties into a lot of very old kind of, like, philosophy about religion. I'm really compelled by the Halsey plotline. You know, I think that, like, as an actress, Natasha McElhone is really interesting. She's charming. She's got, like, the screen presence. And Halsey was a character that was very fascinating to me through season one. As somebody new to the world, like, this is a really important person and I want more of them, right?
Yeah. Halsey, Halsey, absolutely. I mean, it's so funny because Halsey was not a big character in the games. She was sort of a mention at first, but then as the games went on, I think they realized what gold they had in a character like this, and she became more and more prevalent and more of a named character as you know, the lore continued to expand. And I think this show did right by immediately introducing us to her and her depth and her complexity, and she's a fantastic character.
Yeah, if we're tracking John as our protagonist, you need this person in this role, right? I think I think that it's a smart move. I'm really curious, you know, the whole notion, like, I'm immediately looking at the kid of like, oh, is that young you? What's going on here?
This I wondered
like
that
a younger
too.
Version of you, you know. So I'm very curious, but I'm engaged and like I'm in on the Halsey stuff so far.
Absolutely, as am I, and I think that there's a lot of, you know, potential threads that we're sort of rounding out here. One thing that I wanted to mention as well that I think I might have glossed over in the recap is when Ackerson and John are talking about his story, he does say something that I found really interesting from a symbolic standpoint, where he says, I need Master Chief, and we all need Master Chief, but at the end of the day, he's just a guy in a suit.
Yep.
And I, first of all, from a meta perspective, that is an amazing inversion of all the season one criticism of why are you letting him show the face and take off his helmet? And now they're basically being like, well, if you want to actually care about this guy, like, Ackerson could literally replace him with some other dude in the same suit and trick the rest of the general populace, which I wouldn't be surprised if that might happen in some capacity this season. And suddenly you're like, oh, maybe I do actually care about the person underneath the suit a little bit more. So I feel like that was a little bit of a poke.
For sure. And I appreciate it. I mean, look, it like creates tension, which I think is interesting. And it's playing on like the canon in world, right? That, like, who is Master Chief? He's this blank Chief. Master Chief could like walk in and sit down at your family dinner on Sunday night and you don't know it's him, right? Like, you know, it works.
It absolutely does. And so any other thoughts on season two here?
Season two, episode two. Just as somebody, again, coming in really new, like not invested in the canon or the lore or the world or any of the IP, I'm in, you know, I'm like curious, I'm engaged. Like it like activated my curiosity more so than I thought. I think that it's a much stronger start than the beginning of season one. And I'm looking forward to breaking it down with you week by week. I'm psyched to be here with an expert such as yourself to get a little bit of the context that I think I'm probably missing as a newbie, you know?
Oh, yeah. I'm honored to have you here with me. And we're going to be here every week, probably, you know, give or take some potential scheduling commitments. And we're going to give you coverage of this entire Halo season two. You can always subscribe at Post Show Recaps, or we have a dedicated feed at postshowrecaps.com/Halo, where you can come and join us for the rest of the ride here. And ultimately, we have some really fun threads to tie up coming up, and the most notable of which is it seems like Ackerson and Chief both know that some stuff is going to happen on Reach, and so I would be shocked if that didn't culminate next episode, but it's possible. We got an entire, like, spin-off episode in season one before the
combat, gotta imagine if they're naming maps for you in the title that it's gonna pop off next week, man. I'm ready.
Oh, for sure. I'm looking forward to it, and would love anyone who'd like to join us on the ride. We're having fun here. And Rich, where else are you having fun out on the internet? Where can people find you?
Oh gosh, once in a while I'm over at twitch.tv/DMPhilly looking to fire up some Dungeons and Dragons, streaming role-playing games when I can, hoping to be playing some video games in the next couple months. The VODs for all that stuff on YouTube of the same name. I'm breaking down Masters of Air with Ariel. It's been really interesting. It's the kind of final companion, I shouldn't say final, but the third companion piece along with Band of Brothers Adventures in the Pacific from Tom Hanks, Steven Spielberg, Amblin Production Company over on Apple TV. So if you dug those shows, I know Band of Brothers is beloved, the Pacific a little less so. Masters of Air is coming in strong. Four episodes into season one. Ariel and I having fun breaking it down every week. I'm at DM Philly on that place that I still call Twitter. Hit me up there. Let me know what you're thinking about Halo. And yeah, that's about it, Corey.
Yeah, awesome. Well, I have significantly less than that, but you can find me also on Twitter, Instagram, Threads, many places at Cavix, C-A-V-X, and you know, hit us up and we'll chat Halo. If you have any feedback, generally speaking, feel free to send it our way as well. And we would love to see you back here. I was gonna say same time, same place, but that is literally not true in any sense of the word. Whatever time you decide to listen to the next episode and whatever place you decide to listen to it, we will be there. Hope you will too. Until then, we'll see you next time. And Rich, at Winter Peak of 23, you had like a really fun quip at the end of every episode. You have something for us? I didn't want to put you on the spot.
My God, I gotta go play backgammon with Kevin Mahadeo to get my nose to stop bleeding. We'll see you next time.
Bye.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry, we were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right, ChumbaCasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.